So you're Lawrence. Her voice was husky with amusement. Yes, ma'am. Come in. She's almost ready. The O'Keefes had a suite with three bedrooms. This meant the younger sisters were in the lounge, giggling. He'd met them that afternoon, and the three of them had spent a short, sparky time establishing boundaries. True, like all younger children, they were irritating, but they were too wrapped up in the wonder of a new world to be completely odious. He took their teasing in good humor, reminding himself that Rosalind would have to endure his own siblings one day. That is, he hoped she would. When she came out of her bedroom, she was wearing a simple navy blue dress with a skirt less than halfway down to her knees. It made her even more alluring than her bikinis. "Have fun," Lucy said. The bar was of a type indigenous to five-star hotels the universe over. Straight ahead of the door was a small semicircular marble counter with dozens of liquor bottles displayed on mirrored shelves. Deep settees and plush chairs were arranged around small tables. A high ceiling was cloaked by low lighting. And inevitably a grand piano stood on a central podium where a tuxedoed crooner would sit and entertain elderly guests for the evening with tunes never less than a century old. Tonight, a less respectable culture had taken over. The band up on the podium was all electric, playing power ballads. Bottles of beer were cooling in tubs of ice on the bar, and a buffet had been laid out along one wall. Half the floor was given over to dancing, where hollow projection rigs sent iridescent sea-swell waves crashing across the energetic boppers in showers of dazzling kaleidoscopic spray. Lawrence recoiled slightly as the elevator doors opened on the lobby. He wasn't used to quite so many people packed together. There were a number of the teenagers from the water polo game in there, throwing themselves about enthusiastically. Rosalind grinned wolfishly at the sight and grabbed his hand, pulling him through the doors. In the end, it didn't matter that he didn't know how to dance like the others. There were too many hot bodies pressing in against him to allow any vigorous moves. He just shuffled about watching Rosalind. She danced a dream, swaying in lithe slow motion, her arms flexing in time to the rhythm. They grabbed food from the buffet and talked by shouting over the music. She drank her beer straight from the bottle. They danced some more, drank some more. With blood pounding, his skin sticky with sweat and alcohol humming sweetly in his head, Lawrence folded his arms around her in the middle of all the swaying people. She flowed up against him, resting her head on his shoulder for a slow number. Golden light broke over her, shimmering into deep violet. They smiled in lazy unison. Lawrence tilted his head forward, and they were kissing. The band called it a day at 2 o'clock in the morning. Lawrence and Rosalind were among the five couples left standing. "That was lovely," she murmured. "Thanks, Lawrence." When the elevator doors closed, they kissed some more. There was an urgency about it this time. Lawrence pushed his tongue deep into her mouth. Then the elevator door opened. They kept on making out all along the corridor. He slid his hands all over her back before finally clutching at her buttocks. Somehow he didn't have the courage to grasp her breasts or slide his fingers up inside her skirt. "I can't," she said breathlessly in his ear. Her tongue licked at him, making him quake. "Mother will wonder where I've been." The door to her suite opened. "Tomorrow?" he gasped. "Yes. See you at the pool. 9 o'clock. His head was spinning so hard it was a miracle he even made it back to the elevator, never mind his own room. "I can't." That's what she said. Lawrence dropped on his bed, still fully clothed, as the room wobbled about dangerously. She was talking about sex, with me. We were kissing all night. When he closed his eyes and breathed in deeply, he could still feel where she'd rested against him. The skin she'd touched seemed to glow hotly. But what had she meant when she said yes? All he'd asked was, "Tomorrow?" Nothing else. It had been completely open. And she'd said, "Yes, yes." The sleep that should have arrived instantaneously, thanks to all that beer he'd guzzled, eluded him for hours. Lawrence was sitting on a sun lounger by the pool by 7:40. He was the first guest to get there. Several gardening robots scuttled out of his way as he walked across the lawn. A faint mist from the irrigation system hovered over the grass, making the blades glisten under the coral light. Visually, it was an inspiring start to the day. Rosalind arrived at 8:50, wearing a loose midnight black toweling robe and carrying a shoulder bag. They grinned at each other. Lawrence tried not to make it too uncertain and sheepish. "You're early," she said. "Didn't want to miss any of the day."
"Are you all right? You look tired."
"I'm fine. Didn't sleep much. My feet ached after all that dancing."
"Poor thing."
She kissed the top of his head and plonked herself down on the sun lounger opposite.
"Have you had breakfast?"
"Not really." He'd rushed out as soon as the alarm woke him. Hadn't even cleaned his teeth. Probably a tactical error if he hoped to kiss her again.
"I know just what you need."
She went over to the bar, which was still closed up, and started talking into the phone handset. A few minutes later, two waiters arrived carrying trays. They sat up at the bar, peering under the silver lids covering a profusion of plates and dishes. Rosalind made him swallow a couple of pills first, headache and stomach settler. He was only allowed to sip his iced orange juice for a few minutes until they took effect. She'd ordered popped rice, yogurt with fruit slices, scrambled egg with hash browns, sausages, bacon, black pudding, button mushrooms and tomato, then finishing up with crepes and honey. There was toast and blood orange marmalade if he wanted it, too, and a pot of Assam tea.
"This is good," he said loyally.
Normally he got up at about 10:30 and breakfasted on hot chocolate and chocolate cookies. Actually, although the fruit and yogurt was a bit crummy, the rest of it was pretty tasty. Rosalind spread some of the marmalade on her toast. Apart from the yogurt and fruit, it was all she had. Most important meal of the day. His mother always said that, but coming from Rosalind, he could understand and appreciate the meaning. "Any plans for today?"
"Just going to hang," she said lightly.
"Me too." She rested her elbow on the bar and put her chin in her palm to give him a quizzical look.
"You're funny, Lawrence. I've never met a boy quite like you before."
"What do you mean?"
"Half the time you act like you're terrified of me."
"I'm not," he protested indignantly.
"Good to know. You've got lovely eyes, halfway between gray and green."
"Oh, thanks." She broke off a corner of toast and popped it in her mouth.
"Which is your cue to give me a compliment? Any part of me you like?"
A strength of will that he never knew he had stopped him from looking directly at her chest. Instead, he gazed right back into her shining gray eyes. "I wouldn't know where to begin," he said softly, and blushed. For a moment she held still, then a wide smile spread across her lips.
"That sounded like a pretty good beginning to me. For someone who comes over all reticent,
you've got the moves, Lawrence." "That wasn't a move. That's what I really think."
Her hand touched his knee, squeezing gently. "You're really sweet. I didn't understand that. I thought you were just being Mr. Chill, sitting back while the rest of us were charging around the pool like crazed kangaroos, like some big wolf eyeing up the flock to decide which one to eat."
"Sorry, but you're a really terrible judge of character. I was sitting there because I didn't know what to say to anyone. Stupid, really."
"No, not stupid. There's never anything wrong in being yourself. I think I was hoping you weren't a phony like those lads who've been trying to chat me up these last few days."
He grinned. "It's like you're a boy magnet. I was watching, you know, when I was sitting being Mr. Chill. Their tongues were rubbing against the floor when they trailed after you."
"You should have heard some of the lines. I'd love to show you around. Dublin sounds just like my dome. You must visit." "As if some polythene greenhouse could possibly be like a 1,000-year-old city. Jeez,
I came off a starship, not the Ark.
It's like they're all country cousins from Einstein County."
"Right," he said cautiously.
"Einstein County."
She raised an eyebrow at him.
"Where everyone's a relative, to be sure." Lawrence burst out laughing. God, you are just so amazing. She pulled a modest face and did some make-work tidying of their trays. All the while, they just smiled at each other. He'd never been so perfectly comfortable with anybody before. Did you have a boyfriend back in Dublin?
Not really. I was quite keen on one. We went out a couple of times. Nothing happened.
Well, nothing too serious, anyhow. Thank Mary. We both knew I was leaving, see? I figured out in the end he thought that meant whatever he wanted would be for free. I wouldn't be there afterwards, so he wouldn't have to go through all that emotional cramp to dump me for the next girl. Can you believe it? What an asshole.
He's bonkers. If I'd been him, I would have found a way to follow you here, stowed away or something.
Dear Mary, what have I gone and found?
She stroked his cheek, almost as though she was testing to see if he was real.
So what about you, Lawrence? Have you got a girlfriend?
You can be truthful with me now.
I won't mind.
Nothing for you to mind. I don't have anybody.
Now I know I'm on an alien planet. Let me tell you, in Dublin, you'd have been triple dating at least.
Any chance the two of us can go back there together?
There now, just when I think you're smart, you go and say something like that.
Dublin's the same as the rest of Earth.
It's old and tired.
And we're both here now. On a planet that's got a future, without any of the problems others have.
Are you still so sure there's not a big fella up there rolling the dice for us?
Seems to me I couldn't be this lucky naturally. I'm the lucky one. He leaned forward quite deliberately and kissed her. Her hands went around his head, mussing up his hair, holding him closer as they grew more passionate.
People were talking noisily as they walked over from the hotel to the pool. Lawrence and Rosalind ended the kiss and stared at each other. He didn't feel a trace of embarrassment. Quite the opposite, he felt certainly without arrogance. Both of them knew what they'd started and knew that the other knew. It was almost relaxing.
"Won't be long before my sisters get here," she muttered.
"Oh, great." They both laughed and made their way back to the sun loungers. The newcomers were mostly the younger kids. None of them paid much attention to Lawrence and Rosalind.
"We'll have to wait half an hour for our food to go down before we swim," she told him.
"Right." He watched eagerly as she slipped out of her robe. Today it was a scarlet bikini, and he stared without shame. She blew him a mock coquettish kiss and settled back on the sun lounger. Her sisters arrived soon after. Lawrence greeted them with a cheery hello. The four of them chattered away, with the young girls giggling every time the band and dancing of last night was mentioned. When they all jumped and dived into the pool later on, he endured the girls' attempts to push him under and bounce the big beach ball off his head, retaliating by diving and grabbing their ankles underwater. They laughed and shrieked happily. He was quite surprised when Rosalind eventually said, "That's it for me." He threw the beach ball as far as he could, laughing as Mary and Jenny raced off in pursuit. Rosalind was squeezing her hair dry when he got back to the sun lounger. He held out a hand, which she took hold of. "I need a fresh towel," he said. There was a moment of horrendous vertigo while she gave him a level gaze. Then she nodded.
"All right," she murmured. "It had better be your room, though."
He regressed to his original self for a while. All he could do on the walk back to the hotel was give her sheepish, nervous looks. She was equally timid, almost as if she were puzzled by who she was with and where they were going. In the elevator, they kissed again, but it was awkward this time. When he closed the door of his room, anxiety was making his fingers tremble. Rosalind gestured at the broad balcony with its glass wall.
"Can you shut the curtains? I know it's silly, but..."
"No." He almost ran across the room to pull the heavy fabric along the rail. When he finished, the room was suffused with a warm golden glimmer, and Rosalind's superb body was cloaked in alluring shadow. She was looking at the big double bed, a slightly forlorn expression on her face. That wasn't what he wanted at all. He wanted her to be smiling and begging him to hurry. "Look," he said in despair, "we can really just collect some towels if you want."
She turned from the bed and held out her arms for him.
No, she said when they were touching. I don't want towels.
She kissed him again, and this time the old heat was back.
And I know exactly what you want.
You. She slipped free and took a step away. Her hands reached behind her back, flicking the bikini top's clasp. The scrap of cloth fell from her, exposing wonderfully pert breasts.
You're beautiful, Rosalind, he said, so quietly it was as though he was speaking to himself.
Cursing his clumsiness, he closed his fingers around her nipples, tweaking the dark, erect buds of flesh. He heard her inhale, a hiss of pain. She frowned in protest.
Sorry, sorry.
He eased his grip slightly, but never let go. He couldn't do that. He'd never believed she could be so firm, so smooth, warm. She took his hands gently and slid them up to her shoulders so she could kneel before him. Lawrence whimpered as she pulled his trunks down. She looked at his rock-hard erection with a blank curiousness, then tilted her head back to smile up at him. When she stood up, he pulled hurriedly at her bikini bottom, tugging it down her legs. One hand kneaded her breast while the other ran down her belly, feeling the soft pubic hair, the wetness, and the heat. He half pushed, half carried her onto the bed. Their hands clutched at each other, mouths open, licking, sucking, devouring, and tasting flesh. Breathing came hard and harsh. The sensations she left across his skin were driving him crazy. Lawrence knew from all the eye-blue shows he'd accessed how you were supposed to go slow, to caress and stroke a woman, to arouse her, to consider her feelings. But in the heat and semi-darkness, he could barely remember the facts he'd been shown. In the here and now, he'd got the most beautiful and randiest girl in the universe panting and twisting underneath him. Her delectable legs were flung wide. There was a quick flinch of apprehension scarring her face as he penetrated her. It changed to a kind of dismayed delight.
Oh, bloody hell, she grunted. Just go easy, all right?
Of course, he promised, of course. As if he would ever do anything else. He began to move in a slow rhythm, as gently as he possibly could. He couldn't believe it was possible for anything to be this exquisite. Her incredible body squirmed beneath him, because of him. The grip she had on his cock was raw ecstasy. Little moans and surprised gasps of excited joy kept bursting from her clenched teeth. Gentle and slow became impossible. He thrust into her fast and furious, fucking hard, just like that vision the very first time he laid eyes on her. He came in great shudders while she cried out. They rolled apart, him gasping for breath amid the wonder and glory. His head lolled over to see her chest heaving, and he just about came again. He was in love, smitten, besotted, obsessed. He would kill for her, die for her. He smiled in simple-minded happiness.
I'm yours, Rosalind. I mean it. You own me now.
The corner of her mouth lifted up, the nearest to a smile she could manage. Her expression was troubled, reluctant.
What? He cried.
Lawrence, please, don't be so rough. He wanted to throw up. He was the worst shit in the world. He'd hurt Rosalind, the only person who'd ever loved him. Hurt her.
Oh, shit. I'm sorry.
His fingers shook as they hovered above her. He was too afraid to touch her now.
I didn't mean to. Please, oh, please. Shush. It's all right.
She turned onto her side and stroked his brow.
I'm all right. Just a bit sore, that's all.
We won't do that again, ever, I promise.
Yes, we will, Lawrence.
But it hurt you, he protested.
Lawrence, it was our first time. We'll learn to make it different.
She grinned wryly. The rest of the human race doesn't give up so fast now, does it?
No.
She licked around his ear. If I get as much pleasure out of it as you did just now, would you want to stop?
Oh, fate, no. No way.
Well, then, you want to try again?
Astonishingly, his cock was growing hard again at the mere thought.
Not that, exactly. Not for a while. Can we try something else instead?
Sure. That was it for the rest of his holiday. 3 days spent up in his room, the pair of them naked on his bed, bodies locked together and writhing heatedly as they experimented with each other. They rested when they were too tired or sore to carry on, going back down to the pool for a swim or eating in the outside restaurant. After walking the dome's perimeter, they'd go back upstairs for another few hours of total physical excess. Lawrence accessed an I-Sutra file, and they worked their way enthusiastically through the positions and different acts. The furniture was sturdy enough to be useful, and the big marble bathtub with its powerful spar nozzles was simply glorious fun. Their lovemaking was only possible during the day. Rosalind insisted she still had to go back to her suite for the night. He didn't mind. He didn't mind anything she said or did. She was his for the day, and the definition of night was pushed back later and later every time. On the last day, she didn't leave him until 3 o'clock in the morning. "Our apartment is in the Leith Dome," she told him as they clung to each other on top of the rumpled sheet in those last few hours. "Is that very far from you?" "No. I got a trike for my last birthday. I can ride round in less than 10 minutes. Or if we cut through the public tween dome tunnels and walk, it's about 25 minutes. Probably best while we're in the Wakening." In his mind, he was working out the best route, which domes to go through. "So it will be easy for us to see each other?" she asked anxiously. "Very." He stroked his fingertips along the curve of her hips, the way he'd found excited her most. She snuggled up against him, bestowing a multitude of quick, playful kisses along his neck. They tickled. "And you've got my DP code?" "Yes." He moved on top of her, pinning her arms down. "I'll call you as soon as I get home. I'll call you an hour later. I'll call you an hour after that." "I'm sorry. I don't want to be a possessive bitch. I just want you." "You'll be in Templeton a day after me. We'll see each other first thing, in the morning at school." "All right." She nodded slowly as if they'd been discussing a legally binding contract. "I'll wait till then." The limousine that picked up Lawrence and his father early the next morning took 5 hours to drive back to their home. Lawrence sat back in the leather seat and stared out moodily at the thick dancing snowflakes. The only thing he saw was Rosalind curled up in his arms, smiling fondly as they soaked in each other's warmth. "Is your bracelet pearl broken?" Doug Newton asked.
"Huh?"
Lawrence shifted his attention back inside the limo.
"No, Dad, it's fine."
"But you're not using it."
"Don't feel like it."
"Hell, we'd better go direct to the hospital emergency department."
"Dad?"
Doug caught the tone and suddenly focused hard on his son. Indigo script faded from his optronic membranes.
"Yes?" "We've got house rules for everything."
"Look, Lawrence, I don't invent them specifically to annoy you. They exist so that we can all live under the same roof in a vaguely civilized fashion."
"Yeah, I know all that. But you've never said what the rules are about girlfriends."
"Girlfriends?"
"Yeah."
"But you haven't..."
"Oh,
you kept that very quiet, son. Do we get to meet her?"
"I don't know, Dad. What are the house rules about that? Is she even allowed to visit?"
Doug Newton eased himself back into the seat and gave Lawrence a long look. "All right, son. You're virtually old enough to use your voting shares, so I'm not going to treat you like a total child. In return, I expect the same courtesy, okay?"
"Yeah, right."
"There are two sets of house rules. Your girlfriend will be very welcome to visit. In fact, as you damn well know, your mother will insist on it the instant she finds out you have one. When the young lady comes around, the pair of you can do what you want. Play tennis, soccer, go swimming, study together, all that jazz. She will also be welcome to join us for meals when she's here. What she cannot do is stay the night, not in your room. Understand?"
"Yes, Dad."
"The other set of rules are very simple, and they are the same as in real life. You do not get caught. Neither myself, your mother, and especially not your brothers and sisters, are ever to be put in the position of walking into a room and finding you screwing her ass off. Do you understand that?"
Lawrence knew his cheeks were bright red. He could feel them burning. This was turning into a hell of a week for fundamental life changes.
I get it, Dad. Don't worry, that won't happen. Glad to hear it. Just make sure the lock on that cave of yours works properly.
It does.
Doug Newton shook his head in bemusement. I'll say one thing, son. You never fail to amaze me. I take it she is real, not an eye program.
Of course she's real.
Thank fate for that. Does she have a name?
Rosalind O'Keefe.
I'm not sure I know an O'Keefe family.
They're not an Amati family, Dad. They just got here.
Really? Well, that means they have a decent stake, then.
Is that all you care about? That they're rich or players?
As it happens, yes, it does matter to me. But as we both know by now, what matters to me doesn't even register with you.
It does. It's just...
Lawrence didn't want to say the wrong thing right now. He'd never talked with his father like this before. All this honesty was almost making him feel guilty for earlier behavior. He supposed he had been slightly inconsiderate to his parents recently, but life here wasn't easy. They always seemed to want so much for him and from him.
I know.
Doug held his hands up. I'm an ogre. You think you're different to me? If you ever find the time to talk to your grandparents, ask them about the fun they had bringing me up.
Really?
Like I said, if you ever talk to them.
Yes, Dad.
That's my son. As soon as he got home, Lawrence loaded her DP code into his den's desktop pearl and asked the AS to connect him. Her face filled the sheet screen, smiling down at him, the faint freckles dusting her cheeks with the size of his palm. They talked for an hour. He called her another 3 times that day before finally going to bed to sleep. During the night, he woke up twice, reaching for her. In those blurred moments before he was fully awake, he was unsure if she wasn't just a dream. It was a terrifying experience. Hillary Air High was in the center of its own dome, a 3-story H-shaped structure, big enough to provide first-class educational facilities for 1,500 pupils. The ground around it was mostly sports fields, with a constant all-year-round climate, approximating the start of a temperate zone autumn. It was an unusual sight for kids who'd grown up in a city where each dome took pride in its horticultural layout. There were no trees at all, just a flat expanse of verdant grass, interrupted by various styles of slim white goalposts. Not quite as unusual, though, as the sight of Lawrence Newton standing on the steps 90 minutes before the new term officially started. Despite the weather, he'd driven his trike to school to make certain he wasn't late. Now he was shuffling his feet about impatiently as he tried to look at all 9 tween-dome tunnel arches simultaneously. Pupils were emerging from the twisting caverns to walk toward the school's glass entrance hall. Already, several groups were forming on the plaza outside, friends catching up with each other, sports teams bonding before the term's action, pupils behind on their coursework, usually Lawrence, desperately searching for a crib to download, in-crowds being cool together. He saw her easily enough even when she was 100 meters away, shouted and stuck his hand up, ignoring the curious glances. She saw him and smiled, waved back. He ran over, and they embraced in the middle of amused onlookers. That kind of public kissing was against school regulations. Lawrence didn't care.
"You're here," he said dumbly.
"Yes," she grinned around nervously. "I didn't have anything else to do today." They were attracting just too much attention for Lawrence to pretend to be blasé. He put his arm around her, and they walked to the side of the steps. Rosalind said the trip from the hotel had been fine. The apartment in the Leith Dome was okay, except for some problem with the building's network cables. They only had a few pieces of basic furniture, so her mother wanted to go around all the stores that weekend.
"Are these clothes all right?"
she asked, fingering her sleeve. She was wearing a long, dark skirt with a white blouse and jade-green sweater. With her hair held back in an enameled butterfly clasp, it made her look very prim. Lawrence found the style arousing.
"You look perfect."
True, some of the other girls wore clothes that cost a lot more, but it sure as hell didn't make them look more attractive. He saw Alan Cramley giving them a sideways look, focused more on Rosalind than himself. They shared a lot of the same low-grade classes, although Alan had recently turned into a soccer maniac and was actually quite good at the game, which gave him considerably more kudos than Lawrence in their year's food chain. Alan leered behind Rosalind's back and gave Lawrence a quick thumbs up. Lawrence's immediate annoyance that anyone should disrespect his beautiful girlfriend in such a fashion was more or less canceled out by the gender bond approval. He'd never had that before. "So, what do I do now?" Rosalind asked. Lawrence spent the rest of the morning taking her through registration, then showing her the layout of the building. He introduced her to as many people as he could, just about everyone he knew, actually. It didn't take him long to notice that with Rosalind by his side, their greetings were warmer than they used to be, girls as well as the boys. After lunch in the canteen, they went back to the entrance hall, which was housing the sign-up session for that term's sports and activities. Rosalind put her name down for badminton, track training, girls' soccer, piano, and accountancy. "What are you after?" she asked brightly after they'd done a complete round of the tables. "Not sure," he mumbled. He'd never even been to a sign-up session before. They did another slow circuit of the hall. Software development was the first choice for extra studies. He reasoned that whatever he wound up doing in adult life, that would come in useful and it would help supplement his coursework. There was a flight club, which almost made him say, "I didn't know this was here." Flying would be cool. He'd played enough eye simulations, normally involving alien fighters and dogfights, to know he'd enjoy the real thing, and the whole concept was still a powerful totem left over from his old ambition to pilot starships. He put his name down for it, which won a smile of approval from Rosalind. It was games that gave him a real headache. In the end, he went for cricket, mainly because the training was the same afternoon as her soccer, so they'd stay behind together, but also because it was about the most non-energetic game he could find in the syllabus. They had to part for the afternoon when classes started, but he waited for her in the entrance hall afterward and asked her home. "You should know," he said apologetically. "Mum's been badgering me to bring you back. I can put her off for a couple of days, but it's like trying to stop Barclay's glacier from melting. It's got to happen sometime." "That's okay. I'd like to meet her."
"You would?" he asked cautiously.
"Yes."
"Oh, okay, good. I brought my trike. We can get home on that."
"A trike? Lawrence, I've only got these clothes. I can't go outside."
"I know. I'm not totally stupid." He led her down to the garage at the end of the dome. His trike stood almost by itself in the rack, a small machine with two rear wheels powered by a high-hydrogen combustion engine that was encased in metallic purple bodywork. A sleek, elongated bubble of plastic gave the driver and passenger a degree of cover from the elements, although it was open along both sides. The three broad tires had deep snow treads, but even so he could never open it up beyond 50 kilometers per hour without risking a skid. 10 years ago, every teenager in Templeton either had one or wanted one, but the awakening had severely curtailed their use, yet another sign that Lawrence had been born into the wrong age. He dived into the bin beneath the seat and pulled out two pairs of thermal overalls. "See?"
"Oh, yes." Rosalind rolled her eyes. "Really useful when you're wearing a skirt."
Lawrence knew his face was coloring.
"It's all right. I'll manage." She started to hitch the fabric up.
When she was riding Pillion, with her arms tight around him, Lawrence steered them through the thermal cycle lock and out onto Templeton's roads. There had been a light drizzle of hail at lunchtime, which the snowplows had brushed away. The road surface was slick with antifreeze fluid that curdled with melted water, producing the dull shimmer of oil rainbow patterns. Despite his thermals and helmet, he was glad of the bubble's protection. The wind chill was ferocious. Templeton's domes glowed with a steady opalescence under the low, forlorn gray sky.
The cityscape had acquired a blunter, more industrial-looking architecture these days, appearing less complete than it had during his childhood. The delicate fringe of grass and raulia plants, scrabbling for life along the side of the roads, had virtually disappeared. Concrete drainage ditches had been dug in the icy mud along every major route, with excavation mounds piled carelessly alongside. The only remaining signs of botanical life to be found were the rancid green streamers of algae that clotted the deep thaw channels slicing through the scree. Dome air intake vents were now all fitted with new filters to keep the powdery snow and sticky sleet out of the fans and heat exchange mechanisms. Great boxy affairs of galvanized metal held together with crude rivets standing on legs of steel I-beams. Similar ugly incrustations adorned the factories, additional shielding hastily erected over inlets and grills. Worst of all for Lawrence was the rust. He'd never realized there was so much metal involved with the city's construction, blithely assuming its component parts were all sophisticated modern composite, held together with intricate molecular bonds. But they weren't. Metal remained the cheapest and easiest method of fabrication. Templeton had been screwed, riveted, nailed, reinforced, and bolted into a cohesive whole like every other human conurbation since the Iron Age. And now it was paying the price of that cheapness in Amathai's wakening climate. Rust oozed from every structure. It was the city's sweat, exuded from a million filthy pores. Grubby red-brown stains dribbled and wept along each surface, sapping its strength in an eternal drip of oxidation. Lawrence was actually relieved when they turned onto the ramp down to the small underground garage that served his family's estate. There was nothing outside for him now. Amathai was squeezing the humans back into their ghettos of technology, veiling the landscape they aspired to conquer. One time at school, the teacher had told them how Scandinavian countries suffered the worst suicide rates on Earth during their long nights. Lawrence understood why now. It wasn't just coincidence that the hours he spent with eye dramas and games had increased steadily since the wakening started. The steps up from the garage opened out into the semi-arid dome. Rosalind looked round at a desert of rugged rocks and white sand. Glochidiot and tomentose cacti of every shape flourished amid the wiry scrub grass, their umbellate flowers forming vividly colored crowns. Palms and fig trees encircled quiescent oasis pools where lizards baked on flat rocks around the edges. After the drive from school, the air was wonderfully warm and dry. "Doesn't anyone live here?" she asked. "No, the house is in the main dome. This is like an environment park. We've got six." He caught her troubled expression. "What's the matter?" She wouldn't meet his gaze, and if anything, the question just upset her further. "Rosalind, please." She was suddenly in his arms and crying. It was heartbreaking to see her so distraught. He felt as if he was about to cry himself. All he wanted was for her to stop. Every feeling he ever had for her was suddenly intensified, and even through the tears, she was beautiful. "I promised myself I wouldn't do this," she sobbed. "Do what? What is it? Is it me?" "No. Yes. Sort of. What you are." "What do you mean?" "I'm being so weak. But nothing's stayed the same after Dad died. Everything's different every month. Sometimes it seems like I have to face something new every day. I hate it. I just want to stay in the same place and have a dull, boring routine each day, just so it'll give me some stability." "Hey, it's all right." He stroked her back gently. "You're here to stay on Amathai, and believe me, there's nothing more boring and routine than Hillary Air High." She still wouldn't look at him. "I checked up on you."
"You did?"
"Yes. Your family's got a seat on MacArthur's board, Lawrence."
"Yeah? So?"
"You didn't tell me."
"Because it never came up. What's that got to do with anything?"
"I thought, you're rich, and you'll have a million connections and friends here. I know how much society and position means to this world,
and I just got here, and we're not rich. I thought I was your little bit of holiday fun. You've had me now. I thought that was it. I wouldn't see you again. And you'd be laughing about how easy I was to all your friends. And then you were waiting for me this morning, and her tears had returned. He cupped her cheeks with his palms and gently tilted her head so she had to look at him. I never thought that. I can't believe you thought it. Rosalind, you're going to have to put up with me for the rest of your life, because I'm never going to find anybody as wonderful as you. Never. And if anybody should be worried, it's me. You're going to take one look at all the jocks at school and realize what a mistake you've made.
No.
Her hand found the back of his head and pulled him down for a kiss. No, Lawrence. I don't want some brain-dead jock. I want you.
They stood still for some time, arms wrapped around each other, while the geckos and salamanders filled the dome with strange calls. Eventually, Rosalind smiled meekly and wiped her hand across her face, smearing the tear trails.
I must look a mess.
You look beautiful.
That's very sweet, but I'm not going to meet your mother like this.
We can stop off at my den first, I suppose.
Lawrence experienced a mild tingle of doubt as he opened the garage door.
Looking at his den with Rosalind standing beside him, he was uncomfortably aware of how, well, nerdy it must seem. His own private empire. As such, it revealed a little too much about his real self.
Rosalind walked into the middle and turned a slow circle, taking it all in.
It's very...
sad? Egomaniacal? Tasteless?
No. Just that it could only belong to a boy.
Rosalind ran her hand along the back of the battered leather settee. She looked at Lawrence. He stared back. The bottom of the door hadn't reached the ground before they were tugging frantically at each other's clothes.
"What do you do in here?" Rosalind asked afterward.
She was lying along the settee, her head resting comfortably in his lap. Lawrence was still having trouble with the concept of a naked girl in his den. The two factors simply didn't compute. Although, now he thought about it, having sex in here had been severely exciting. The forbidden fruit syndrome. "I don't do a lot. It's just somewhere that I can come and relax, be myself."
"Okay, I can understand that.
There's times I wish my dearly beloved sisters never existed, and I was cooped up on a starship with them for a month. No escape.
But what do you do when you're being yourself?"
"Nothing really interesting, I guess. I used to be quite into electronics and stuff. That's what most of the junk is. I just haven't got around to fixing it all. I do a lot of home study in here. Play a lot of eye games."
"Like the Halo Stars?"
"That's a new one, actually." He stopped, slightly abashed. But then he did have a nude girl half sprawled over him. "You couldn't get more personal than that."
"When I was younger, I'd spend hours watching my favorite show up on the big sheet screen." "What was it?"
"I doubt you've heard of it. Flight Horizon."
Her nose wrinkled up. "I think I know the name. It's an old sci-fi show, isn't it?"
"Yeah, about a starship exploring the other side of the galaxy. Amethi only imported one series, though. I'll never know what happened to them and if they made it home."
"Why didn't you send a message to the distribution company back on Earth?
It can't cost that much to get the other series sent."
"I tried that 1,000 times, but I never get any answer. I guess the company's folded." "Nothing is ever lost from the data pool. That's why it's expanded beyond its homogeneity globe. It's not that the original network design was faulty. People just kept adding so much memory capacity that the interconnectivity broke down. There are whole sections that are almost autonomous. Other sections don't know what's in them, or even that they exist. If you need anything slightly quirky these days, you've got to load in a dozen different askpings and hope one of them finds a metalink for you.
When I was looking up Amethi, some of the data took days to get back to me.
Nothing mainstream, just the peripherals. Early survey reports, startup finances, that kind of thing. Specialist stuff.
There are even rumors about closed pools existing. Sections that only have internal metalinks, and their AS controllers don't know they're no longer linked to the outside.
That sounds crazy. You can't lose information in Amethyst, Data Pool. One asping will find you anything.
That's because it's still small. Earth's data pool breakdown was inevitable. There's too much data to be indexed in a single source, and the more the index is distributed, the weaker the metalinks become. They're talking about giving it official subdivisions. Except if you don't know where all the original data is stored, how are you going to rearrange it?
No wonder I couldn't get an answer.
If you like, I can send a message to a friend I know. She can load an asking for the show.
Lawrence tumbled off the settee. He wound up kneeling in front of Rosalind, who was regarding him with intrigued amusement. You can get the rest of the episodes for me?
We can find out if they exist, yes. Entertainment is still mainstream. Unless it's over a century old, of course. Even then, it's pretty easy.
Please. He clamped his hands on her knees. I would be eternally grateful, and I will sign that in blood.
She pondered the notion for a moment, eyes unfocused on the ceiling. There is one thing I'd like.
It's yours.
She took hold of his hand and licked his fingers one by one, ending with a kiss at each tip. Then she began to move him slowly across her body until the place he touched made her gasp.
That, she murmured huskily. I like that. Every day for a week, Rosalind went back to the Newton family estate after school. Sometimes they drove on the trike, but often they'd walk through the Tween Dome tunnels. It wasn't until the third day she was introduced to Lawrence's mother and brothers and sisters. He worried about the meeting a lot more than she did, wincing every time his mother was nice or asked a personal question, glaring at his siblings when they shouted a crass comment. Rosalind sailed through it with a grace he envied as much as he admired. After that initial encounter was over, he wasn't obliged to bring her into the house every time, although it was made very clear she was to come to a meal whenever she was visiting. And it would be lovely to meet her mother for lunch one day, soon.
Parents, she sighed when Lawrence glumly relayed this latest development. They never booked themselves into the nursing home. They just stay home and embarrass their children.
He glanced up from licking her navel. You know what'll happen, don't you? My mom will start introducing your mom to eligible men.
Rosalind shifted around. They'd put a blanket on the settee now. The leather used to stick to her bare skin. I doubt it.
He heard the tension in her voice.
Sorry. You don't talk much about him.
No.
She let out a long breath. I don't. There's not much to say. He was a great father. I loved him lots. Then one day he was gone, and everything I thought was my world went with him. And just when I thought my life was going to be completely shitty from then on, I came here.
She pinched a roll of flesh around his waist, which made him squirm.
And there you were, waiting for me.
Something else we've got in common. My life was pretty shitty, too, until I met you. I don't mean it was as bad as you losing your father. No way. Mine was all self-inflicted, most of it, I guess. Easier to bring that to an end.
Well, I'm going to inflict some more suffering on you.
What?
Lawrence, I can't keep coming back here after school.
Why not? He asked, shocked. Don't you like this? Her grin was dangerous as she clambered on top of him. Oh, yes, to be sure I like this. Way too much, in case you hadn't noticed. 2 weeks with you, and I've turned into a complete slut.
She pushed her breasts toward his face.
Me too. He licked her nipples, urgent for the taste of them. Even after all this time, he was still amazed at what she let him do. His own bravery in suggesting things was surprising, too. It was as if neither of them owned a single inhibition between them.
Rosalind lifted herself out of his immediate reach. I've got to start doing some serious home study. Amethyst schools are ultra-fast-tracked compared to dear old Ireland's. If I'm not careful, I'm going to wind up the biggest dunce this planet has ever seen.
You won't.
Lawrence, I will. I'm serious now. I have got to get my home study done.
Do it here, he said simply. There's data pool access. You've got your bracelet pearl with you. No problem.
His hand went up, ready to fondle her breast. Rosalind sat back, hands on hips, to stare down at him.
You know what'll happen if I come here to do it. You'll start cuddling up, and then we'll wind up fucking, and I'll never get anything done. Do you want me to be a total idiot?
Of course not, but he couldn't bear the idea of not seeing her outside school.
I won't get fresh until you've finished your coursework. Promise. Just please, come back here in the afternoons. Please? Cross your heart and hope to die.
His finger drew a cross on his chest. Absolutely.
Okay, then.
Great.
But we go to the house first. Do our home study there.
Ow, what?
That's the deal. We work together in the lounge or somewhere. That way neither of us can lapse.
Oh, hell. All right.
And afterward, she leaned down again, taunting. Afterward, we can come back down here and I'll show you how grateful I am.
Will you? Her tongue licked around the outside of his lips at the same time he could feel her nipples brushing across his chest. The provocation was a beautiful torment.
Oh, yes, she whispered.
How grateful is that, exactly?
So grateful I won't be able to talk. My mouth will be too busy.
Lawrence's moan was almost a whimper. His eyes were half shut, pleasure blurring his vision with tears. Trepidation made him tremble as he felt her hand curl lovingly around his balls. Then, bastard fate, her other hand pinched the fat at the side of his belly and he juddered free.
Her beautiful face was pouting with disappointment. What's the matter?
I don't like that, he grunted shamefully.
You mean this?
Her hand reached for the band of fat again.
Yes.
He shifted sharply out of her way. There's no need to remind me I'm overweight.
Rosalind frowned. You are your body, Lawrence, just like me.
But your body is fantastic, he avoided saying, whereas mine...
I know. I keep meaning to get into better shape.
He shut his mouth quickly before anything else stupid could escape.
Really?
Her face lit up and she kissed him enthusiastically.
That would be such a turn-on for me.
Chapter 6 Can time, the period that ground forces can spend in transit before their combat performance will start to deteriorate, was a factor that military commanders had known about for centuries, building it into all their tactical planning. According to ZB's manual, their strategic security forces could endure a 50-day trip in a starship without any noticeable decay in efficiency. At 40 days into the flight, which put them still 3 light-years from Thallspring, Lawrence was already wondering if any of Platoon 435 NK-9 would even get into the drop glider when the time came to go planetside. Whatever office lurker expert had come up with the 50-day rule had clearly never been in low Earth orbit, let alone a starship. Day 41 at 0930 ship time, the platoon were in the gym. With the rest of the day given over to non-physical training and mission revision, it was the wrong time to be doing anything strenuous. The high they'd come out with would take hours to fade, leaving them hyped and edgy. But every platoon was scheduled for 90 minutes a day in one of the life support wheel's gym compartments, keeping their muscle and bone structure up to scratch. There was no getting out of it. Even knowing it would screw with the rest of his day, Lawrence concentrated hard on his exercise regimen, pushing rhythmically against the stiff resistance of the handlebars. He was prone on one of the starship's standard apparatus benches, which used only springs or pistons to provide resistance. He tightened the resistance settings a couple of notches and carried on. Sweat began to build up on his forehead. His heart was pumping fast. That was the response he wanted, keeping every organ at its peak. He'd emphasized that enough times to the rest of them and then led by example. Their skin suits placed a lot of strain on a body, especially one that had been rotting away in an eighth of a G for 5 weeks, something the canned time charts tended to overlook. Glancing around the gym, he could see Amersey and Hal Grabowski putting in a decent amount of effort. Sweat was staining their scarlet T-shirts. Odell and Carl were getting away with the minimum, as always. Jones Johnson was barely moving his leg restraint, treating the session as some kind of personal rest period. Typical, Lawrence thought. Jones was their platoon's mechanic, and damn good with just about any sort of machinery, including projectile weapons. Naturally, he assumed that ability compensated for his lack in others. Despite being a member for 3 campaigns, he never seemed to grasp that the platoon survived by teamwork, which started at the most basic level, physical adequacy. Lawrence got up and casually threw a towel around his neck. He loped over to Jones and grasped the frame around the man's bench apparatus to give himself some leverage. His free hand slammed down on the leg restraint bars, forcing them to hinge round and bending Jones's legs almost double.
"Fuck!" Jones yelled.
"You've just been ambushed. A mine has blown a wall down, pinning your legs under a shitload of stone, and 3 rebels with machetes are coming toward you. If you want to live, you've got to lift yourself free."
"Jesus, fuck!"
"Come on, you idle bastard, lift!" Jones's face was compressed into a rubber mask as he strained to bring his legs back level. Blood vessels stood out on his neck, pulsing fast. When it was clear he'd never get the bars back, Lawrence let go. "You're fucking useless, Jones. I don't mind that it would get you killed. We might get a halfway decent replacement. But if you're immobilized, it leaves the rest of us covering our asses. Keep up with us or drop out now. I'm not carrying a liability."
"This is a fucking gym, Sarge. If we're out on patrol, I'll be in skin. This fitness crap we're supposed to stick to is total bullshit."
"The only thing you can ever truly rely on is yourself." Lawrence caught Hal grinning at the scene. He turned to the kid. "And you can stop smirking. In 6 days, we're going to be on the planet. Every welcoming smile you get means they hate you. The bigger the smile, the more they want you dead. We've only got each other down there. Nobody else is going to look out for you. So I want you in the best shape it's possible to be. Not just your body. I want your attitude to be right, too. Because, fate help me, I've got to depend on you." He walked back to his own apparatus bench. Hal resumed his pumping, seemingly proud of how high he'd got the resistance turned up and how easily he handled it. Amersey, who hadn't stopped his forward presses, gave Lawrence a look of mild rebuke as he passed. The corporal wasn't out of line, Lawrence admitted. He had overreacted to Jones slacking off. But this time he wanted a lot more from the platoon than on any other mission. If he was ever going to achieve his personal objective when they reached Thal Spring, he needed to have complete loyalty, and to do that, he had to take care of them. Good care. They might not appreciate it up here, but on the ground, these missions quickly became very warped. Society's assholes they might be, but they were street smart enough to know who they could trust when the shit hit the fan. And ZB, in the form of Captain Douglas Bryant, didn't get a look in. Lawrence began working his apparatus again. He could see Jones pedaling wildly and let out a quiet snort of satisfaction. It was lucky the squaddy hadn't tried to smack him one. The frustration of can time was twisting them up. At least back in Cairns, they could sneak out of the base at night and screw the tension away with a girl on the strip. After Jim, the platoon was due 2 hours equipment readiness training. Lawrence left Amersey to supervise them by himself. He'd got another meeting with the captain. This close to the end of the voyage, they were averaging out at nearly 1 per day. Their briefing room was a rectangular compartment with bare aluminum walls, apart from one large, high-resolution sheet screen. The 3 other platoon sergeants, Wagner, Sayarin, and Oakley, were already sitting at the composite table. Lawrence gave them a quick nod and took his own seat. Captain Douglas Bryant walked in a moment later, accompanied by Lieutenant Motluck. The sergeants rose to their feet, all of them with one hand gripping the edge of the table to keep their feet on the ground, while the other was used to salute. "At ease, people," Douglas Bryant said cordially. He was 28, a product of ZB's Officer Academy in Tunisia. A smart man with a solid family stake in the company to propel him along the promotion path. While Lawrence accessed his record, he found the only active duty the captain had seen was counterinsurgency missions in East Africa, punishment raids on camps deep in the jungle, where the native tribes still fought the imperialist company mines, stripping the minerals from their land. It was a qualification of sorts for asset realization, but Lawrence would have preferred someone with genuine experience. If he was honest, his contempt for Douglas Bryant originated from knowing the young man was more or less what he would have probably turned out to be himself, genuinely concerned about the condition and morale of the men serving under his command, full of information and knowing shit about what really mattered. "Sayerin, have you got your platoon's supply inventory sorted out?" the captain asked. "Sir," the sergeant of platoon 836 BK5 answered. "It was a glitch. The supplies were in the correct lander pod." The captain smiled around at his sergeants. "It's always software, isn't it? Have we had anything other than virtual problems since we left Centralis?" They smiled back, tolerantly polite. "Okay, final suit tailoring. How are we doing? Newton, your platoon hasn't started yet. Why is that?" "I keep them going in for function tests, sir. I want to leave final tailoring until as late as possible. Even with the gem sessions, 5 weeks in this gravity is messing with their size." "I can appreciate the reasoning behind that, but unfortunately it's not quite the procedure we're following. Your platoon is to report for final tailoring 0800 tomorrow." "Sir, I can't risk them not being ready when we emerge from compression. We must not be caught unprepared." "Right," Lawrence thought. "Like Thal Spring has moved, and we're going to finish this flight early." Final tailoring took a couple of hours per suit at max. "I understand, sir." And so it went. Bryant was obsessed with details. Everything any experienced commander would leave to his sergeants to sort out, he wanted a say in. He had to have the operation running perfectly along the standard track, a dead giveaway that he was concerned more with the impression he generated within the company than with the practicalities of the situation they'd be facing. He even wanted Oakley to cancel a request he'd made for more remote sensors when they got groundside. His platoon had been assigned to sweep through an urban area that was all narrow roads and a maze of cheap housing. And that was from a 10-year-old map. It could have decayed a lot since then. In other words, a perfect ambush territory for the local bad boys. And they'd have a lot of bravado before ZB established themselves and obtained their good behavioral collateral. Lawrence would have wanted the same security those remote sensors could provide. But despite ZB's vaunted policy of loop involvement, the beachhead plant already contained the number of sensors considered relevant. Bryant did not want anything to alter at this stage. Oakley said yes and got his bracelet pearl to rescind the request. They moved on to the landing operation's timing and how Bryant didn't want them to suffer undue delay on their way out of the drop gliders. A gentle warm rain had been falling on Memu Bay for most of the day, the second unreasonable downpour in a fortnight. It meant Denise had to keep the children out of the garden and at the tables and benches sheltered by the roof. In the morning, she'd handed out the big media pads and got them to paint the shapes they saw in the clouds, which resulted in a splendid collage of strange creatures in glowing blues, reds, and greens. By the afternoon, when it was obvious the clouds weren't going to blow away any time soon, she settled them in a broad semicircle and sat on one of the tables in the center. "I think it's time I told you about the planet of the Mortif," she said. Even though Mozart never actually visited it himself. There were several sharp intakes of breath. The children gave each other excited looks. The dark history of the Mortif planet had only ever been hinted at before whenever she talked of the Ring Empire. Jed Zealous stuck her hand up. "Please, miss, it's not too horrid, is it?" "Horrid?" Denise pursed her lips and gave the question some theatrical consideration. "No, not horrid. Although they fought terrible wars, which are always evil. I suppose from where we are today, looking back, it's really quite sad. I always say you can learn the most from mistakes, and the Mortif made some really big mistakes. If you remember what they did then, I hope you'll be able to avoid those same mistakes when you grow up. Do you want me to go on?"
Yes, they yelled. Several of them gave Jadzella cross glances. All right, then. Let's see. Mozart never went there, although he did fly close to the Ulidan Nebula, where the planet and its star were hiding. There wasn't a lot of point to him going. Even in those times, the Mordif were long gone, and nothing they'd left behind could have helped him in his quest for a grand purpose in life. Although, in a way, a very warped and twisted way, the Mordif had an overriding purpose. They wanted to live. In that, they were no different to all the rest of us. Humans today and the sentient species of the Ring Empire all want to live. But by fate, or accident, or chance, or even luck, the Mordif evolved on a planet in the middle of the darkest, densest nebula in the galaxy at that time. They had daylight, just as we do. The nebula wasn't thick enough to blank out their sun, but their night was absolute. The night sky on that planet was perfectly black. They couldn't see the stars. As far as they knew, they were completely alone. Their planet and its sun were the entire universe. Didn't they send ships out to find other stars? Edmund asked. No, because they had no reason to explore. They didn't know anything else existed, and observations backed up the whole idea. So they didn't even know they could go looking. That was their downfall, and it's the lesson we must learn from them. You see, like most sentient species, they thought in the same fashion we do, even though their bodies were very different. They were big, almost as big as dinosaurs, and they had very clever limbs that could change shape. It meant they could slide their bodies along the ground, the way a snake does, or they could swim like fish by turning the limbs into fins. And some Ring Empire historians and archaeologists even thought they could fly, or at least glide. But that didn't stop them from having an ordinary civilization. They had a Stone Age and an Iron Age, just like us. Then they went on and had a Steam Age, and an Industrial Age, and an Atomic Age, and a Data Age. And that was where their troubles started. By then they had developed their whole world, and they had good medicine that gave them a long, healthy life. Their population was expanding all the time, and consuming more and more resources. Whole continents became giant cities. They built islands miles across that were just floating buildings. All of their polar continents were settled. There was no room left, and all the surface was being exploited. It meant they had wars, horrid, terrible wars that killed tens of millions of them every time. But they were always pointless, as all wars are. After entire nations were destroyed, the victors would just move into the ruins, and within a generation, the land would be full again. All the while, their technology, especially their weapons technology, grew more powerful and more deadly. The wars they fought became worse and more dangerous to the rest of the planet. Then, one day, the biggest nation, which was ruled by the greatest Mordif overlord, discovered how to create a wormhole. The children let out a fearful, "Oh!" Did they invade the Ring Empire, miss? No, they didn't invade the Ring Empire. Have you forgotten? They didn't know it was there. They made their wormhole go in a very different direction. You see, wormholes are formed from a distortion of space-time. We use ours to create a tunnel through space so we can fly to the stars. The Mordif traveled in time. Because the Ulidan Nebula denied them a vision of space, time was all they knew. The Overlord ordered a single giant wormhole terminus to be built, standing at the center of his nation. It was the greatest device the Mordif had ever constructed. For not only did the terminus generate the wormhole, its own structure was self-sustaining. As long as it had power, it would never decay or fail, and it got its power from the way it distorted space-time. In other words, it was eternal, almost like perpetual motion. "My daddy says that's impossible," Melanie said with haughty self-confidence. "He says only fools believe in it." "It is impossible," Denise said, "but that's the best way to describe how the Mordif's terminus worked." Edmund sneered at the girl, then turned to Denise. "Why did the Overlord build it, miss?" "Ah, well, that's where the terror and the tragedy of the Mordif begins. When it was finished, the Overlord ordered an exodus of his whole nation. An armada of flying craft carried them all into the terminus,
millions and millions of Mordiff. And when they were all safe inside, the Overlord's personal guards set off the most terrible weapons the nation possessed. All of them, all at once. They were so bad and so powerful that they killed every living thing on the whole planet and turned all the cities to rubble, even those of the Overlord's nation. The children stared at her, awed and troubled. Every Mordiff nation had the same awful doomsday weapons. Some spread deadly diseases, while some simply exploded hard enough to open up cracks in the magma below the continents, Denise said. The Overlord knew it would just be a matter of time until somebody used them. By then, each of the nations was so desperate for new land and resources that not using the doomsday bombs would mean they'd collapse from within. So now the Overlord's nation was inside the wormhole, traveling further and further into the future, away from the time of the planet's death. Some of them, a scouting party, emerged 100,000 years later, flying out of the terminus, which had survived the explosions and radiation, of course. To the scouting party, it was only minutes since they'd entered the wormhole, but as soon as they came out, they found a sterile planet, with the ruins of the megacities crumbling into dust. By then, the radiation had decayed and the plagues had died away. These Mordiff scouts dumped bacteria and algae over the surface and flew back into the terminus. Then they came out another 1,000 years later, when the bacteria had spread everywhere, bringing the soil back to life. This time they scattered seeds before they went back into the terminus. The third time they emerged, they left breeding pairs of animals and fish. 1,000 years after that, the world had returned to the state it was in before their industrial age, with huge grassy plains and forests and jungles. That's when the whole of the Overlord's nation came out of the wormhole. They'd only been flying inside the wormhole for a couple of hours, while outside, 120,000 years had rushed past. They looked around at this beautiful, clean new world, and they rejoiced and thanked the Overlord for delivering them to this wonderful place. Many of them forgot the crime that had been done to give them this chance at a fresh life and settled down to rebuild their original society. So once more, they mined the land for metals and minerals, and their cities began to grow again, always expanding over the wilderness. After a few generations, some of the Mordiff forgot the debt they owed to the Overlord family, which still ruled the original nation, and began to break away and form new nations of their own. 2,500 years later, the planet was once again covered with cities. Once again, wars were being fought. So the Overlord of that time did what his ancestor had done. He gathered his nation into flying craft and sent them through the terminus. Behind them, the doomsday weapons exploded yet again. This wretched cycle turned another 3 times. Whenever the world grew too crowded to support the billions of Mordiff who filled the cities, the Overlord's nation would escape through time and kill everyone left behind. But after the last time they fled into the terminus, the scouts came out 100,000 years later to find something unexpected had happened. Their sun had changed. When they looked at it, they could see dark sunspots swelling and bursting all across its surface. It was reaching the end of its main cycle and growing colder. Of course, as they'd never seen the other stars in the galaxy, they didn't know what was happening. They never knew that stars change and die. They'd assumed that their little universe was static and eternal. The physicist among them began to speculate and produce theories at once, and they probably worked out what was happening because they were smart, don't forget. But knowing what's happening and being able to do anything are very different things. So the scout group took measurements and recordings of how cold the air was becoming and how frigid the land had turned, and went back into the wormhole to report to the Overlord. At first he didn't want to believe what they told him, but eventually he came out and witnessed the stars' winter for himself. By now the ground and ruins were covered in a thick layer of frost which glimmered in the dimming sunlight, and the seas were frozen solid. For a long time the Overlord raged against what he thought of as supreme injustice before he regained his senses. Scouts were dispatched far into the future, 200,000 years, 500,000, 1,000,000, 2,000,000, even 10,000,000.
They all came back with worsening reports of how the sun grew colder and colder, swelling into a huge red monster that covered a fifth of the sky. At no time did it ever show signs of returning to its original state.
"Can stars do that?" Melanie asked quietly. "Get better, I mean?"
"No, dear, they can't. Not by themselves. There are stories that some kingdoms in the Ring Empire tinkered with the interior of stars when the Empire was at the height of its powers, but they're only stories. And for all their knowledge and technology, the Mordif were never as strong and wise as the Ring Empire. So the Overlord had no choice. He had to order his people out of the wormhole as soon as the effect of the Doomsday weapons had faded away, and while the sun still had some warmth. In that respect, he was a good leader, doing the best he could. He ordered that the new cities were to be built under protective domes. Their technology, he said, was enough to turn back the tide of night. Which, in truth, it was. They could still live on their planet, protected from the cold under skies of crystal. Fusion power would provide them all the light and heat they could ever want. But these enclaves were harder to build and took even more resources to maintain. It was a difficult life, and by now the Mordif had evolved for war and conquest. They knew nothing else. After so many generations devoted to endless conflict, the outcome was inevitable. Once their population began to expand again, the ordeals and deprivation hit them harder than ever before. The domed cities fought each other. It was insane because they were so much more fragile than the open cities of old. And this time there was nowhere to flee if anyone let off the Doomsday weapons. The only thing in their future now was cold and darkness. According to the Ring Empire archaeologists, the last of the Mordif died out less than 1,500 years after they emerged from the Terminus for the final time. The Ring Empire explored the Ulidan Nebula 25 million years later and found a few fractured remains amid the ice that shrouded the whole world. All that was left of a species that had covered their planet with cities and marvels. The children sighed and shivered. Many of them glanced out at the sky for reassurance that their own sun was still there, as bright and warm as ever. The clouds were clearing above Memu Bay now, shredded by the offshore wind into gravid streamers. Broad white gold sunbeams prized their way through the ragged gaps to chase over the land. Denise smiled with them in reassurance at the water that glistened so refreshingly on the plants in the garden and the trees outside. "That was scary," Jadzella announced. "Why did they all have to die?" "Because of their circumstances. The nebula meant they could only ever look inward. We're luckier than that. We know the stars exist. It should help us develop a more enlightened attitude toward the way we live and behave." Denise tried hard to keep the sarcasm out of her voice. One of the girls waved urgently. "What's enlightened?" "It means being nice and sensible instead of being stupid and violent." She paused and smiled round. "Now, who wants to go out on the swings?" It was still too wet, and she'd get a telling off from Mrs. Polchanski for letting them get their clothes damp, but they were at their happiest when they were gallivanting around outside. She couldn't bear to take a moment of that away from them. They pelted out from under the roof, cheering and racing each other to the swings. Denise followed at a slower pace. Running the Mordif tale through her mind always conjured up a melancholic mood. The story of their tragedy had too many resonances with humanity. There, but for the grace of God, not that she believed in gods, human or alien. Her prime alerted her to a priority spacecom alert diving through the data pool. Two fusion plasma plumes had been detected 8 million kilometers out from Thal Spring. Spacecom was scanning for more. Data traffic rates between their offices and tracking satellites doubled inside 15 seconds, then doubled again, increasing almost exponentially. Denise's hand flew to her mouth as she looked round at the children. Their carefree shrieks, giggles, and smiles pounded into her consciousness, and she was suddenly fearful for them. She tilted her head back, searching the section of sky that Spacecom's coordinates indicated. In relation to herself, it was a 9-degree window just above the western horizon.
There were too many clouds in the way to permit any sighting of the tiny blue-white sparks she knew were there. But their presence acted like an eclipse on her heart, making her world colder and darker. It had begun. Captain Marquis Crogan sat back in what he liked to think of as the command chair on the Corriboo's bridge. In practice, it was just another black office chair equipped with freefall restraint straps and bolted to the decking behind a computer station. There were 11 other identical stations in the square compartment, arranged in two rows of six facing each other. 9 of them were currently occupied in readiness for exodus. When he was a junior officer on his first couple of star flights, he'd managed to get a place in one of the observation blisters in the forward drive section for exodus, his captain of the time agreeing he was an essential for the operation. He'd waited spellbound with his fellow young officers as the moment approached, putting up with cramped limbs and stuffy air just for the chance to witness the transition. In the end, it was as uneventful as most events aboard a starship. The wormhole wall, a blankness that wasn't quite black, slowly faded away, allowing the stars to shine through, almost like a lusterless twilight creeping up on a misty evening. That had been 30 years ago. He hadn't bothered with visual acquisition since, preferring the more precise story of the display screen graphics and his D&I grid. 5 of his own junior officers were currently crammed into the observation blister, a reward for reasonable performance of duties during the flight. They'd learn. "Stand by for exodus," Colin Jeffries, his executive officer, announced. 10 seconds. There were so many displays counting down that the verbal warning was completely unnecessary. Tradition, though, like so many things on board, orchestrated the crew's behavior, helping to define the chain of command. His D&I showed him the ship's AS powering down the energy inverter. The plasma temperature in the tokamaks began to cool as the magnetic pinch was reduced. Power levels fell toward break-even, producing just enough electricity to keep the ancillary support systems up and running. All around the Corriboo, the drab monotony of the wormhole faded away to be replaced by normal space. Holographic panes on top of the bridge computer stations turned black, showing the steady gleam of stars relayed from external cameras. The AS activated various sensors, aligning them on thaw spring. Several of the bridge officers cheered as the bright blue and white orb materialized on their panes. "Let's face it," Marquis thought, "we have little else to do." Bridge officers were simply a last fail-safe mechanism, nothing more. The AS ran the ship, while humans made small decisions based on the minute fraction of tabulated information it provided them through holographic panes and D&Is. Summaries of summaries. There was so much data generated by the millions of onboard systems that it would take a human lifetime just to review a single frozen moment. 8 million kilometers, as near as you can squint, Marquis said, after analyzing his D&I information. Radar active. We're searching for the rest of the ships. Simon Roderick leaned on the back of the captain's chair, inspecting his displays. Very good. I expect that as we tracked their compression distortion while we were in the wormhole, they won't be far behind. Marquis didn't reply. Everything Roderick said, the way he said it, was an assertion of his assumed superiority. A captain should be master of his own ship, as indeed the other captains of the Third Fleet were. But with Corriboo acting as the flagship on this campaign, Marquis had endured Roderick's presence for the whole flight. He'd been subject to a stream of advice and requests the entire time. Every night, Roderick had dined with the senior officers, making it a miserable meal. The man's conversation was rarefied, discussing culture and economics and history and company policy. Never a joke or a lighthearted comment, which put everyone on edge. And he'd occupied 5 cabins. 5! Although Marquis no longer begrudged him that, the board member spent most of the ship's day cosseted away there in meetings with his ground force commanders and the creepy intelligence operatives Kwan and Raines. "What's the reaction drive status, Captain?" Roderick asked. "Engineering crew are priming us for ignition." Marquis kept his voice level and polite. Roderick could access as much data as he could, probably even more, given the access codes he had. The question was just a reminder of the strategy he'd insisted on. Normally, a fleet would hold its drift positions at Exodus, waiting for every starship to arrive before maneuvering into formation and heading into the target planet. This time, Mr. Roderick had decided that there would be no formation. Each starship would start its fall-spring approach flight at once. With the starships strung out, the planet's hypothetical exo-orbit defenses would be more exposed when they deployed. The lead starship would take the brunt of the attack, but provide the remainder with first-class targeting information.